give that shit up, you can concentrate on golf.
If you can dodge a wrench, you can dodge a ball.
Great moments are born from great opportunity.
You play ball like a girl!
Hi everybody and welcome to a Roy Orbison Tattoo Podcast with me, Cullum, and my co-hosts, Mossy and Paul. This is episode 4 of season 3. If it is your first time listening, I would advise to go back to the start and listen from episode 1, as we will refer to previous shows from time to time. The show does contain film spoilers, so if you've not yet seen the film, I would advise watching it first, might help you understand a little bit better. And now for today's show, I hope you enjoy. And this week we are watching Hoop Dreams, and we've got Laura Finnegan on with us. So, Laura, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks for the invite.
And Mossy and Paul, as always, thanks, lads.
Hey guys, how are you all?
Good.
So, Laura, what I suppose give a brief intro to your background, and I suppose why you would have chosen this movie as well.
Okay, well, I'm a lecturer in talent development and sport management in Waterford IT. A little bit about my background. My master's is in sports psychology. As I said, I'm lecturing, so the typical pathway was to go down the PhD route. So I waited until I found something that I was really interested in, and trudging home from the Euros in Poland a few years ago, I said, right, well, player development and those kind of pathways in Irish football was the way to go for me. So started off a 7-year part-time PhD then, which I've just finished this year. So that's great.
Congratulations.
Thank you. So it was on talent development pathways within Irish football. It was three main studies. One actually that mirrors a little bit of Hoop Dreams, which is probably why that the film really struck a chord with me. And probably the film kind of put the parameters on that study that I wanted to do a longitudinal piece of research. So I looked at different things like place and date of birth and some of the demographics of boys already engaged in the talent development pathway in Irish football. I had a stakeholder study because that's really important about kind of the alignment of everybody that's involved in structuring these talent kind of journeys for athletes. And the last one was a longitudinal study of boys that were on the Irish under 15 squad from age 14 to 19. So that's, I think, really where my affinity with Hoop Dreams comes from, because this film has done something similar to that.
Very good. And like, look, I suppose for any of our regular listeners, Shane Keegan would have dropped your name back at the start of season 2. We actually did a bit on Mike Bassett and the relative age effect came up. So I don't know if you've seen the film, but at one stage he goes, right, anyone born in the first half of the year over that side, and anyone born in the second half of the year go that side. And every single player went to the first half of the year side. So I suppose just for any of the regular listeners, they might remember that. But like, that's probably one of the things you've been kind of looking at as well. Like, it would be the relative age effect. And like, I suppose, look, for most of the listeners, they're probably aware of it as well, that the younger athletes or the athletes born in the first half of the year get more opportunities as they go on or earlier in their career. And like, that's something that your studies and research kind of back up, like, don't they? Or does it?
Yeah, it's amazing when you see it, the stark figures in black and white within your own particular context. And it's something that I'd always encourage people to do, is just really simple exercise of getting the dates of births of players that are involved in squads of yours. And yeah, for sure, within youth football and really within most youth competitive sports, you will see a strong relative age effect. So I think off the top of my head, I think it was 40% of the boys on the Emerging Talent Programme at the FAI were born in the first 3 months of the year, with around 10% born in the last quarter of the year. So there always is that pattern to it. A couple of things then, I suppose the thing is not about necessarily saying that it's there, because really it's been in research since the mid-80s, but the problem is that, you know, there's no one silver bullet to try and reduce it, or to think a little bit about it in your pathway. So thinking about, well, how do we make sure that those born later in the year are getting opportunities within your talent development pathway? But then what we have seen is actually a reversal when it comes to that senior age, that what a lot of professional academies in England are seeing is that those born later in the year, maybe the ones that have had to struggle the whole way through, that kind of underdog mentality, maybe they're more likely to convert into pro levels. So how can we still challenge the bigger, more dominant players that may be born earlier in the year or are early maturers? Because sometimes we can let them slide by at underage and relying on their physicality, but when that all levels up, sometimes they're left behind.
And do you think it might be a case of the older, stronger guy that once they get sort of challenged, that they no longer want to push themselves, like they're no longer above anybody else, they're ahead of anybody else, and then they say, oh, I actually have to work it now. Do you think that might be sort of an equalizer, I should say?
Yeah, I'd say there's a few different facets to it. That kind of psychological aspect that you've mentioned there, definitely. And just maybe not used to having to struggle as much. And maybe, you know, if we look at resilience and the development of resilience, and that concept is really important in players and those that progress through system. So, you know, maybe that kind of lack of challenge throughout. So it's always about, like, how can you embed challenge to maybe those that have had it a little bit easy in that sense.
And I was actually checked up the dates of birth. I was looking for the football final dates of birth, but I couldn't get them. But the hurling final, Limerick and Waterford, just give you quick numbers here. And like, as you said, it kind of, it irons itself out as they go up. But there was seven born in the first quarter for both of them. Limerick at 13 and Waterford at 14 born in the second quarter. Limerick at 10 and Waterford at 9 born in the third quarter. And there were 6 each born in the last quarter. And as you said, in comparison to development squads, which we'd have, let's say, I'd spend a bit of time with, it's very, like, it actually has balanced out. And like, as I said, but is there anything that you've come across? Just, look, we're not going to get bogged down in the relative age effectively because I know go down a dark hole, but is there anything you've come across to kind of counteract it? Let's say in just general stuff, let's say if I'm a development officer in Cork and I'm organising game structures, like, is there anything that I could do, put in place structurally to help clubs or help people be aware of it, or but also to counteract it, or is there anything that's out there?
Yeah, I mean, definitely coach awareness. So having these types of conversations and embedding them into the NGB coaching pathways as well is really important. So definitely coach awareness is one, but structurally there's a lot. I mean, if we can leave off the selection process until as late as possible, well, then you will negate some of this relative age effect. Because if we are selecting at around that maybe 13, 14 age group, well, that's where you are talking about these really vast kind of differences in terms of size and growth. And often that is the thing that will make the difference in terms of selection. We call it that the shouting talents maybe versus the whispering talents. And the ones that will stand out are probably those shouting talents that are maybe the early maturing boys or girls or the ones that are born earlier in the year. They're just the differences there. So definitely if you can keep as many engaged in the sport for as long as you can, that kind of mantra of as many as possible for as long as possible will go some way to definitely negate the relative age effect.
Very good. So back to the film then, we'll talk about it. Like we two main characters with William Gates and Arthur Agee. The first thing that kind of stuck out to me about William was his brother, Curtis, and the influence he had on William. As I said, ended up being a negative influence when he had him late for the match, the last game, and they lost it, and there was disappointment. But like, how important? Like, I suppose, what's the value of that for a person? Like, or is there for the second or third or fourth born child that if the older person is interested in it, is that a helping factor?
Yeah, there's really interesting research started to come out about the role of siblings in development. The elite athletes are more likely to be second and third born rather than first born kids. So there's been a bit of kind of exploratory insights into that about why that might be. And it's suggested that it's things like greater hours of informal play. So maybe if you're second and third born, you're more likely to be out earlier playing in the back garden, playing up in that sense. So you're playing against someone older and with a greater range of skills, and you kind of have to get a bit more creative and inventive yourself. So more informal play hours, the idea of playing up and playing with older people, you're probably brought in with their friends as well. So that's really interesting. And even one of my own studies, I followed, as I mentioned, that the five boys, one boy moved from a regional club up to the DDSL and followed the same pathway for his brother. And again, at that very early age, that was quite reassuring to him because they knew and they kind of knew what to expect. There was a familiarity there with the process. They knew the people in the club and they knew what the second son almost would receive there in terms of a football and education. But yeah, it's not all positive either, as we saw with Curtis here. And William does kind of rebel against that a little bit. He does bring that up. He does say, I always felt Curtis shouldn't be living his dream through me because he's getting it from Curtis, but he's getting it from his mother as well. Yeah. Similarly, she's saying things like, I just wanted this one to make it.
Yeah.
You know, they saw Curtis's dream fall through and all of those hopes were kind of ploughed into the vessel almost of William. Everyone else's hopes were poured in there.
That happens a little bit in the film, that you see the impact that the siblings have, but also the family have, in what they're investing into their child's development in that particular sport. Like with Arthur there, and it's well into it before it becomes evident. Like with the mother going through the nursing program to become and being so successful there, and everything being geared towards having money to support the child's ambition, you know, and the negative effect that has on the parents. And like, it is a big thing that I think as coaches, maybe we don't build enough strong relationships with parents at times and with the other significant others in players' lives, you know.
You're right. I mean, look at the huge impact that everything around the two boys, William and Arthur, had in terms of family peers as well. You know, you had Arthur and his friend Shannon there were a kind of key relationship in there as well. And so, yeah, absolutely. I think there's a lot that coaches to do. One thing that always surprised me watching it was, you know, even something simple like the fact that William didn't talk to his coach about the fact that he had a child 3 or 4 months previously. You know, there was no idea that huge seismic shift was even going on in William's home life, say.
Yeah, and I know, Paul, you mentioned one of your, or someone you know in one of the development squads, or had a similar situation not so long ago, was it?
Yeah. It's well over a decade now ago, but it is something that happened. And like, it was really sad looking at that side of the film, because like William's whole viewpoint in that area was like the baby was born at this particular time of the year when we were heavily involved in competition, like, and that was the most important thing. And you know, and maybe as a 17, 18 year old, that would have been the way people thought, but it's only with a bit of wiseness that you realise that isn't the way you should be thinking, maybe at times.
There's a lot of pressure on William from outside, though, wasn't there? Like, he had his brother, his mother, he had his coach, he had everything that he was through. Like, you try, like, throughout the film, it looked like they wanted the career more than he wanted. He had the talent, but he wasn't ready to push himself as much as the others.
There was always that comparison to Isaiah Thomas the whole way through it.
The whole way through it. Now again, like the looking at their social backgrounds, like it's, and a lot of professional players from America, they come from really poor backgrounds, and that's their get out. And you can see why their parents are pushing them, and it's like it's their meal ticket. They're a lot of to win the lotto to get their child to be a professional sports star, or even just to get to the college. Now the coach, I forget his name, from St. Joseph's, very rarely he mentioned the MBA. He mentioned college. We'll get you to college. You get your degree. And I think the degree was for somebody from that sort of background is a big, big thing, isn't it?
Definitely isn't. Like, I was doing a bit of reading up on it over the last few days, like, and it is only 0.09% of high school level players that end up making it to the NBA.
So you're like, reading Laura's paper as well, you were.
Yeah, but like it's massive, like, you know, in terms of what actually gets there. And then like if you look at the different rates of maturation during it, and Arthur was let go from Joseph's, but at that age, because Pingator didn't think he was growing at a quick enough rate. And we've talked about that biological age previously, you know, and the fact that Arthur ended up getting ahead of William within 2 years of that, because of that bit of a setback. And like, you know, you mentioned the rocky road as well, Laura, like Arnie McNamara's wrote about the different pathways to get to the top there in that talent development sphere, you know.
And actually, to me, that's one of the things that I find so intriguing about the film, is that those kind of subtle shifts of fate in it. So something that, you know, you saw him leaving St. Joseph's and going to Marshall, and, you know, it looked like it was a downward path, but actually it was exactly what he needed at that stage. Like, he felt so, you know, if we talk about his transition to St. Joseph's, I mean, he said things like, you know, there was rugs and plants, and I've never seen so many white people. And it was a completely different sphere. And that kind of transition didn't seem to have been managed well at all. So actually, when he got back to something that he was much more maybe familiar with, and he could flourish a little bit, something that seemed like it was, you know, a negative thing at the time, actually, that little kind of subtle shift. Watch out.
Do you see, Laura, from your studies, players who would be going across or having professional careers, that they fit a certain type of club, or an individual would fit a different pathway, where in the film there, Arthur went to St. Joseph's, it wasn't working out for him, but he didn't fit there. Where you can see some professional footballers that might go to a big club, where if the same player of same talent went to that club, they mightn't come true, because they just don't grow there, where they'd be better in a smaller club, where they may feel more of a family effect or something like that.
Yeah, I think, I mean, it's probably like life. I mean, there's always situations where we all feel a little bit more comfortable in, and maybe people that we gravitate towards a little bit more. And I don't think it's really any different in those types of settings.
Yeah, and like, one of the things that I thought was very interesting was, like, it was the two buses scene. So you'd William getting on the bus for St. Joseph's, and the coach shouting at them, "No, you want to be thinking about the game the whole way before the match." And it flipped to the other bus then, when Arthur was on the Marshall bus, and they were playing cards down the back, and the coach was just kind of sitting there, just content out, not bothered. And like, for some players, that's obviously a huge factor as well. I suppose the environment that they encapsulate, that some players, as I said, probably mostly that's what it suits them, you know, that it's a bit more laid back. And like what William said just before that, he said that he just wanted to play, that he felt he wasn't getting the opportunity to just go out and play and do things, you know, give the shovel pass, not be ridiculed for not coming off.
It was like it just became a job to him eventually, didn't it? And you mentioned it earlier, that was, you know, the potential form of that upward mobility. This was his ticket out of the ghetto, and it was just a job. The fun and the play element was gone from it.
Would that be seen like I know that from in the GA and development squads, like, it would be something that would be said by a proportion of players, that they kind of, the fun goes out of it, that they feel they're kind of just going along for the sake of it after a while. Like, I presume it's something like in the soccer as well, that the feedback would be like, do players kind of fall out of love with it?
Yeah, and it's something that comes up at any study that's done about in terms of dropout, and it's, you know, across genders and across ages as well, that kind of lack of fun element to it regularly comes up.
Yeah, and like a Paul and Matthew, you know, you probably when you're involved in the colleges now, that they probably get through that, and it's a bit more relaxed. But you'd see it as well in the college setups, that players, it's not, the college isn't as serious as the intercounty or the club team might be, that we'd always regularly have players who would really embrace the college setting. And for a lot of them, would actually be that second, it'd be kind of like what happened with Arthur. It'd be the kind of a second blow for them, like, that they might just embrace this new sort of environment.
It's a bit of a release.
Yeah, well, like, look, when people have to get up in the morning and they have to rate how they slept, how many hours they slept, rate what their mood is, and they're constantly logging activity and constantly being watched by Big Brother in, we'll say, obviously it's happening in professional setups, but it happening in GA now. They love the fact that they can go out and just play and it not being a serious. And like, I suppose anecdotally, it's been talked about this year that there's been a bit more enjoyment to sport because it's gotten away from that, oh, we need to invest nearly all of our time that we have and all our spare time into preparation when people just want to get out and play and can perform better in that setting, you know, with that limited amount of, not pressure, but limited amount of pressure on preparation.
Yeah, and like one of the other things, another thing that was very interesting, and we mentioned already about the pressure on the mother. Would that be something that would come up, though, Laura, in, like, I don't know if you've come across that, you know, you'd have Shane Keegan mentioned it. He was at a soccer match for whatever, Home Farm or one of these top sides up in Dublin, and there was this parent sort of stood in the corner of the pitch and didn't get animated any bit. And he just took note of the player and he was asking, who's that fella? And that's his father, or player, that's Tomasi's father, let's say. And he just took note of the player. And I think that player got player of the year for the FAI there last year under 17 or under 18. But what Shane was kind of going at was like, you'd have these parents that are going ballistic on the sideline, you know, that the Premiership, like I suppose William's parents, that this is our ticket out of here. Just our ticket to a better life. Well, not in a way, you know. But you had some parents then that are just kind of, yeah, look, whatever happens, happens, and we'll be supportive. And like, would that be something that, like, is there any studies done on that or any information on that that could be passed on?
Yeah, there's been some good studies that looked at the difference between parenting styles on the super elite versus the almost. That's Anya McNamara and Dave Collins have looked at that as well. And yeah, it was the parents that were kind of over invested. Really, the problems there in terms of their own child development was feelings of autonomy. So maybe the kids weren't getting enough feelings that they had a say in what was going on. So kids were lacking those feelings of autonomy. Again, the fun could be stripped out of it as well if someone's there roaring at you the whole time as well. So there is that sweet spot about giving enough kind of encouragement. And again, there's different types of support. Like there's that kind of tangible support. One of the boys in my longitudinal study, you know, spoke about his father, who was a truck driver, and he'd be gone at 3 o'clock in the morning. He's back home at 5 o'clock to bring him to training up in Dublin, and he'd sleep in the car park while his son was training. And that was the kind of toll that it took continuously out of the family. So like, there is probably a whole conversation about like family resources as well now, and what it takes to be an athlete that kind of progresses up the levels. So suddenly now you are talking about more time away, so you know, you do need, probably it has to be a family perhaps with two cars, and you know, that kind of thing. And there's been a bit of work on English football done that actually it's kind of starting to move away a little bit from the traditional kind of working class sphere, because actually now it does take that investment of family support and resources to get you there.
And anything about two-parent families then? Because I can see, like, for my own children, they're young now, but we're already, myself and wife are talking about in a couple of years' time on a Saturday morning, she's going to have to bring one child to one match and I'm going to have to bring it to another match, and then the other child's just going to have to be left there. it's just stuff we're thinking about already. So I'm sure that has to affect parents as the players get older.
Yeah, and that was cited in that work in English football as well, that is now, it's almost a prerequisite, unless you're in an environment or a culture where it's, you know, maybe it's on your doorstep, or where you have good kind of, you know, structured people and that kind of thing. But yeah, it's something that what we might not necessarily have thought about before, that looking a little bit broader than the actual development athlete itself. It's like, well, what's the next level around them? Like, what else is in there? Bronfa Bremer is a good, really good educational researcher that I pinned a lot of my research on. And he talks about these levels around the development athletes and the micro level and what's going on there. And we saw a lot of that in the film. And that was, you know, your siblings, your peers, your family, your school, things that you interact with all the time. And all of those have an impact on you as a developing person, let alone a developing athlete. And then maybe the next ring out from that would be the macro environment. So those bigger, broader things, which I think the film did a really good job showing a kind of shining a light on without maybe explicitly stating that these were the problems in the environment. So again, you know, you were talking about the gangs and the drugs, and I thought one scene that jumped out to me in terms of the cultural differences was it when Arthur turned 18 and his mother made him a cake, and their big celebration for his 18th birthday was the fact that he was alive. The fact that he lived that long was a big kind of celebration there, really, in comparison to you know, everything that himself and his peers were facing on the streets all the time. So I've kind of gone off track there, but the idea of kind of being aware of these broader kind of almost rings around the person and how they impact on the developing person and athlete is really important.
Yeah, and like as well with Arthur and his father, like two particular scenes that were vastly different and 2 years apart. Like the first scene on the basketball court where Bo ends up going and getting his fix at the end of having a bit of crack with Arthur. And then 2 years later, after his short stint in prison and getting himself right, like they have a really, really intense one-on-one on the court where, like, I don't know, like, looking at it, like, there was a big crowd there. I don't know how friendly it was. And it was a real, there's so much in that them two scenes alone about that relationship between the two of them, that's, I really didn't know what to be thinking of what impact this has.
His father was a strange character.
And that must have weighed heavily in Arthur as well, because even his nickname was Man, from Little Man, from the dad, say. So like that was his nickname all the time. So he was always kind of linked to the dad really strongly like that. And then if you remember, I think when the dad left the family, he made a big deal about changing his nickname. He started writing Tuss on his runners. He was kind of done with the man and trying to kind of separate himself out from his dad and his dad's influence and legacy. And that's really huge. But that's something that I think the film does really well, is those scenes and those really kind of intimate scenes as well. Like, I think when you watch on in the film, and it's a fairly lengthy watch, but it nearly gets less as it goes on about the conversations and the interview, say, and more about that observational type of watching and those type of scenes, as you mentioned.
Like, and even the scene where they went to the high school camp and Spike Lee was talking to them, and like, and he was talking about, like, you're a commodity there to make money, and like, it was all, we'll say, black stereotypes. And like, then there was the other scene where the recruiter came to the house. And like, the recruiter said, I'm serving up me, and I'm trying to serve it up nice and neat. Like that is, it's there's so many parts of the film that are real tragic and bleak, like, in terms of what that development pathway in some sports does look like.
Yeah, and the term meat market was used there by, I think, a couple of different scouts in it. And that's really what it was. And they admit in it that it's a business, and there's a really short-term focus. So, you know, on one side of things, you know, we know all the research will say that the most appropriate talent development pathways or journeys are those with that long-term development focus. So, like, to me, that's missing completely here. There's no one looking at this as a full pathway, if that makes sense, or the full kind of how these journeys all merge together. But on that, in terms of the recruiter, I think it was really interesting when the initial scout, like that scouted them when they were 14 and sent them back to St. Joe's, when he came back and actually had said, you know, I have second thoughts about this system and what I'm doing here to boys. And again, that the kind of meat market. And, you know, I'd be thinking about things about, you know, it's going to stop now with Brexit, but, you know, that would have been the way, say, our best young talents here in Ireland would have been, in that sense. I remember going down to the Kennedy Cup and talking to a few people down there, and that term was used down there as well, which is why it struck me in the film. And people used to say that something like the Kennedy Cup was a bit of a meat market. You had people going around with their, you know, their UK club jackets on them and making contact with coaches or parents or players. And so, yeah, there's just a lot of questions there, I think, about just the overall nature of pathways. And
there was a comment on us watching a match at the weekend there, and Robbie Savage made a comment about a player who was gone playing non-league now, who was in the professional underage structures. And he said, basically, majority of players are there just to facilitate teams to get one player through or two players through to their adult setup. And I thought, like, just after watching that this week, it was very similar in terms of these lads are going to college to get on a team, to win a couple of matches, to sell out the stadium so the college can make money. And I thought it was just sad that they didn't really care about the athlete.
Is there any sport, or even lesser sport, let's say clubs within a sport, that would be doing the talent pathway or the development pathway really well? Like, is there any examples of that or what you've come across, Laura?
I mean, I suppose that there's always, you know, snippets of good practice everywhere. I mean, what you're looking at, I suppose for a start, it's about how you're defining success and how you're defining really well. And if we're just defining that as, you know, making it or not, well, then that probably limits the experience that we're judging as well. So, I mean, like, take this, for example, you know, actually both boys finished high school, and it was the medium of basketball that they did that through. Whereas I think if they didn't have basketball, then they wouldn't have finished high school and gone on to college in that sense. So whilst they, you know, in terms of the metrics and the numbers, they didn't make it in terms of going to the NBA, they did make it in terms of finishing high school and, you know, that those kind of positive aspects coming out of it.
Sport plays a massive role for children and pupils like that who might have no interest in education whatsoever, but if they have something to hang on to sport wise they are likely to stay in school and play and actually perform better in school. I can't remember if I said this on the show before, of a guy from a tough enough area, and he had issues with his back family, had issues with drug addiction in his background, and a priest in the school he went to says, unless you start studying, I'm kicking you off the football team. And he started studying, doing a bit of study, whatever it is, ended up in college. He ended up with a top job as a result of the priest telling him that he had to study if he wanted to stay on the football team.
Yeah, and like one of the things in the film as well, and it was a constant for most of the film, was the educational side of it, that they kept they kept pushing the education. You know, you need to get your SATs, you need to get your number, your 18, or whatever it is. And I know really, like, look, they brought, like, William was going out to St. Joseph's because he could play basketball. But they did kind of keep on him about the next phase of it. And I suppose it's something we would have seen, I'd say it's much less prominent now, but we would have seen it in the past in college GA, where players would go to college just to play GA. And, like, how do we get, is there anything you've come across where there's, I suppose, ways of educating the players that, like, education really is important? I know, like, Curtis said it at one stage, he goes, great ball player cares more about basketball than he does about going to school. And I suppose that's why Curtis is where he is, where he was at that situation, that stage in his life, you know. But like that, for a young fella, for a 17, 18 year old, or a 15, 16, 17 year old, that they think sport is the only thing. How do we, is there any, I suppose, look, as I said, is there any studies out there that have been able to, I suppose, educate those kids better, other than communication and constantly down their throat, lads, you have to get the number, you have to get your education right and stuff like that? Because it is, like, I've seen it in the past where players have played matches in the middle of their leaving cert. And I've seen other cases where players haven't played any sport for 6 months before the leaving cert. It's one thing, as I said, the Americans, I think it's 5 out of every 6 kids that are good enough to play college basketball or college baseball or American football in America don't get there because of their education is so low. And, like, it's something I think, Paul, from a college perspective, it's much more proactive towards the educational side, isn't it, with extra grinds and assistance and stuff like that?
I think the value you place in education is dictated by the value you actually place on the sport within the team you're looking after. And if you're always constantly geared towards just, oh, we're aiming to win the match next weekend or whatever the case may be, then that's going to have a knock-on effect in how they view other aspects of their life. And if you have that more holistic view of everything, and everything can rise together, then everything potentially in theory should rise together.
Just getting back then to the FEI there, Laura, do you think there's great potential in the FEI now with Brexit, players not being technical across to Category 18, if I'm correct, that pathways can be put in place with clubs maybe that some of these are in place already, but maybe develop more about college structures and scholarships as college and developing that way?
Yeah, I mean, I hope so. Because really, it's all we have now. We relied on the UK as almost a finishing school for these kind of talented youth. But with that avenue gone, then, you know, we obviously have to look here and look internally. Coherent structures, getting everyone on the same page, which has been an ongoing problem in youth football, you know, across the different bodies that are involved in it, and, you know, different bodies, different leagues, and people having a very different philosophy on how best to structure, I suppose, the game here. So, yeah, I mean, there is massive potential. There has to be. All our eggs are in our basket now. But it does take that joined up thinking, that coherency of approach. And, you know, it will take financial investment as well, which obviously is
key,
an issue at the minute. But, I think, you know, I think people at that decision-making level have to advance it pretty quickly now, so that we're not almost, you know, seeing the loss of a generation. But of course, there's definite advantages to staying here that little bit longer if we can get all those kind of right things in place. I mean, you know, look at some of the issues with transitions there in the film and not adapting well to those types of transitions. And often we'd see that when players go across to the UK, that kind of very different environment, you know, being away from home for probably the first time. Suddenly the realization that everyone's hopes are kind of in you. It's not fun in that sense anymore, that maybe that carefree element is lost. Now suddenly, you know, people are living vicariously through you, and it is more like a job. Versus now maybe being able to stay here, definitely advance education. I think educational institutions have a huge role now to play with this in terms of partnering and giving opportunities and scholarships and assistance and different things. So, there's opportunities, because really there has to be, you know, it can't continue as it has been. Needs people to drive that forward now.
Do you see challenges in Ireland that other countries don't have, let's say, from the perspective of player development? In the film, the boys only had basketball. Like, they weren't playing ice hockey or NFL or American football or anything. Whereas over in England, I'd imagine would be very much, they play less multi-sports than Ireland, let's say. Like, every child probably holds a hurley at some stage. Well, every child in half the country will hold a hurley at some stage in primary school. They'll play Gaelic football in primary school. They'll get an opportunity to play soccer in primary school. Some kids will get an opportunity to play rugby as well as other sports as well. But is that one of the challenges Ireland has from soccer FAI development, let's say, that you've got kids that play so many sports? And I know the FAI brought out, the director of coaching or whatever, about children need to specialise from the age of 12. And it's like, obviously in some countries that's possible because there might be no other opportunities of sports. But in Ireland, that's kind of a challenge for a lot of them, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's an important conversation to have, because really to look at the development pathway in any country, like, you have to look at what makes this country unique. Like, what's every situation has a unique set of circumstances. And I assume it's the same in the GAA as well, in terms of different counties. I mean, I'm from Louth. I hadn't seen a game of hurling before I came to college in Waterford. So, like, you know, that's very different. But definitely in Ireland, multi-sport and the pull of the GAA and soccer, What was really interesting, though, was that actually the boys in my longitudinal study, so as I said, I followed five boys for 5 years, so something kind of similar to Hoop Dreams here, the ones that engaged with GA, it actually was a really positive, it had a positive impact on their football or their soccer playing. So a couple of examples of that would have been if they were facing some challenges playing maybe underage League of Ireland, you know, maybe they were dropped, maybe things weren't going too well for them. They actually went back, played a bit of club football, club GA, and actually just got their confidence back. So even though it was a totally different sport, totally different environment, they kind of got their confidence back. And there is a little bit in the research about this, that idea of an arena of comfort, that, you know, you can bring that. We often hear about the transferability of skills. So, you know, take basketball in this film, an idea of spatial awareness and movement and how that could be brought to different sports. But actually the transfer of kind of psychological skills as well, and that kind of psychosocial skills. The boys would have talked about the benefit that they had for playing GAA and what they took to their football playing then. So things like, you know, a few of them commented that they would have been seen as a bit maybe meaner and tougher from their GAA background. So whilst we might say, look, it's a challenge because there is this multi-sport, and what came through really strongly was the dominance of the GAA in terms of culture throughout Ireland. So when it came to actually at maybe age 17, 18, these boys making a choice, or kind of early, it was 16, 17 really, about, you know, do we go minor? Or a lot of them had the chance to be underage League of Ireland as well. And sometimes it was the cultural pull of the GAA that made them go that way. So that's something for, I suppose, the FAI to be aware of as well, that actually what was prompting people to make these decisions in terms of specialisation was how you feel about the sport. And people will have a more positive assessment of your sport if they feel they've retained that kind of autonomy in it. And if you're being told maybe you can't do this and you can't do that, well, that takes away some of those feelings of autonomy. Yeah. And so whilst that kind of multi-sport culture, you know, we might say that it's a negative because maybe it takes away from necessarily the specific hours that we spend on one sport or another, it has lots of positives. You know, the worst thing that's happened in terms of talent development has been the 10,000 hour rule. I mean, that set back talent development years, because suddenly it became about an hour counting approach. And well, we have to have X amount of hours in for the 10 years before they become maybe this elite athlete. And actually it obviously doesn't work like that.
Yeah, well, if the 10,000 hour thing worked, I'd be playing intercounty still. I would have played it when I was 18. It definitely doesn't. But like, that was really interesting what you said there about the players, that they actually felt a bit of a release going back to play club football and hurling. And I'd imagine, like what you're saying about when it comes to 16, 17, will they play county minor, or will they play whatever, or go towards more, concentrate fully on the soccer? Like, I think what attracts the young fellas, just from what I've come across, what attracts the young fellas going back playing GAA, let's say, because we've come across fellas that have been brilliant rugby players, brilliant soccer players in development squads, is they're going back to their friends, they're going back to the community, the fellas they grew up with and they spent an awful lot of time with. But the biggest, I suppose, the negative factor that they come across an awful lot of begrudging coaches that would say, oh, no, if he's going away playing soccer, no, he's not coming back with us, kind of thing, you know. I've one case now that I know of, he'd be probably, let's say, 16, 17, the player would be, and brilliant soccer player. I'd say, no matter what he did, if he played any sport, he'd be brilliant at it. But he wasn't starting for his club team because one of the managers just had a real gripe in for him that he was playing inter-county, or he was playing for the county team, and he missed a bunch of their club games because he was playing soccer. And we tried to take, like, no, I'm saying we're trying, we're not perfect, nowhere near it, but what we tried to take is that, look, if a fellow wants to go play soccer for a year, or he's unable to make next week's training session, we're not going to cut him off at the head and say, good luck, you're not coming with us anymore. Like, we're trying to be more, longitudinal, that, right, if he doesn't make it into soccer or rugby or whatever sport it is, we'd like to think that he had a good time, a good experience with the GAA, that if he doesn't make it and he's still living here when he's 18, he'll be available to play for the club team or county or whatever. And I think one of the things that, I think it's an Irish thing, I think it's kind of begrudging thing, you know, where people see someone trying to succeed in something else and they're not really supported by everybody. Like if any player from our parish goes on and plays cricket for Ireland or hockey for Ireland, we should all be supportive. But I think a lot of it is begrudging that, sure, he'd be better off now down the GA pitch playing hurling football with the club team. And if he's not, he's a bollocks stick.
I heard a good story there recently about a fella who's playing professional soccer in with Brighton, Aaron Connolly. And someone was seeing him playing for Ireland, because they'd be, sure, he's wasted himself. He could be playing hurling with Galway. Just like, you know.
Yeah,
but like here, there's loads of examples of it. And like there is that element of suspicion there from coaches about the other sport and why are you going off playing that. But like there's like just a couple of anecdotal examples. Like would Ciarán Donaghy be the Gaelic footballer he is if he didn't play basketball? Because of that skill he developed within that basketball setting. And then you look at it, that Dublin GAA, Dublin senior footballers have got Mark Ingall in from a basketball side of things to do coaching and screen work, etc. over recent years, and that's developed them. And like something I've really noticed in, we'll say, hurlers in Dublin, lads who went to schools that play rugby, right? So the likes of Belvedere or Castleknock College, they're extremely good in, we'll say, them rook ball situations in hurling where ball's on the deck and they come out with it. And a real prime example would be David Hawkshaw, who was involved in Leinster rugby, out half there with Leinster. He played both sports, played three different sports, probably more sports, throughout his development years until he took the path he was taking. It's working out for him at the moment, you know. And there needs to be more of that catering for the individual within them team environments. That look, we're trying to work it that they're going to achieve something somewhere, and the longer we have them, the more we can help them achieve that.
And it probably needs someone like maybe a body like Sport Ireland to maybe take almost the lead in that, and actually to have almost somebody on a if not a county by county basis, but at least a kind of regional basis that tries and gets the NGBs all working together. And and maybe you put in something like financial incentives to do that, because you know, for all the NGBs, like it is, we're working from a small talent pool. So how do we keep that as wide as possible? So I definitely think Sport Ireland could have a role there.
Like New Zealand came out with that last week, that they're looking for cooperations among all the governing bodies to make sure that they get people through. And like people talk about Ireland being a very unique situation with Gaelic games, but New Zealand is very similar in terms of its multi-sport. They just haven't got the Gaelic game side of things, but they are very much a multi-sport nation, and they do all feed off it. So like I think per capita, are they doing the best medals wise Olympics in the Olympics? That could be.
Sounds legit. I'll leave it in.
It could be completely wrong now, but they do overachieve based on their population size, and it's down to them that we'll say multi-sport attitude they have, and that play attitude they have towards sport.
Yeah. So they have big investment in sport down in New Zealand as well. Like I remember reading a stat years ago, just back in college, and they said for every million they spent on sport, they were saving 7 million on their health. Just
that kind of foresight wouldn't be happening in Ireland, Mass.
No.
But like as you said, Laura, like one of the things I'm amazed by the amount of money that clubs, let's say, in a various town. I just think, let's say, I used to work in Rush and St. Mars, and there was soccer in the club in the town, and there was cricket, and there was rugby from Skerries used to come in and coach in the schools. And it's before different coaches going into the schools on a weekly basis. And like if all the clubs came together and said, right, we'll do this, we'll do under-8 training for GA on this night, under-8 training for soccer on this night, and everybody was able to kind of collaborate, and we'll do cricket at this time of year when soccer is down, and work together and put multi-sports into training and supports into the schools. Like, God Almighty, you could imagine how successful a little town could be all of a sudden, you know, if they were all pulling together and maximizing, as I said, the playing base that they all have, so rather than the GA getting a third and the soccer getting a third and a third not playing or doing something else. Let's try to get 90% doing everything and just work with each other, as opposed to the constant, that shower over there, they can put on a match now the same time as ours, or they have to change in training and we lose four or five of the lads, you know. And it's just a small bit of cooperation. I think what you said, like, as it be it Sport Ireland or be it someone at the top, that there has to be better communication. And like, I think the biggest problem we have within the GA, and it's probably the same in soccer, I'd imagine, with down the grassroots, is when it's volunteer led, it can, that's where the cracks can come. If it was like, I know, I think Iceland, do Iceland say they have a professional soccer coach in every village or every town? Like, that can keep a standard high at everything they do within the club. But when you've got volunteers, and like, as I said, one of the big things that have in the GA would be if there's a rogue mentor, he's kind of left get away with it because Ayrshire, look, he's doing good fundraising there during the year. And, you know, and he kind of gets, we apologise for his behaviour then because of that. But yeah, side rant there. Anything else in the film that stood out for you, Laura, that might be of relevance to coaches?
Well, just when you're talking about the rogue coach there, I thought how it finished with Coach Pingator and William, when, you know, William just said he was going to study communications in college so that if ever Coach Pingator came looking for something, that he'd know how to turn him down. And I just thought, like, this was 4 years of their relationship together, and, you know, this is the impression that the coach leaves on the player. I just thought it was astounding, and a real case of maybe what not to do and how not to approach that kind of relationship building.
Yeah, he said he'd remember him making him run the steps or something like that, whether they run the stands. And that's the memory that you have, is a negative memory you have over 4 years.
I thought as well, that was another one. There were so many scenes that kind of really shock you, and you're trying to figure out exactly what's going on. For me, that scene when that happened and Pingator tried to start explaining the reason he'd done things and why he was as harsh as he was also really important, like, because he was going, well, I'm going to make this 4 years really difficult, but and maybe he won't have a positive view on me, but in 10 years time the penny might drop with him that, you know what, them 4 years is after making these 15 years in the future much easier because of that ground and I got there. So, like, yes, I'm not saying coach like Pingator at all, but and his methods were harsh enough, but being able to coach with that aim of the long term in mind of, I'm not going to see the best of William or Arthur or a particular person, and there's that, say, delayed gratification of seeing someone successful in some walk of life miles down the line, you know.
But was that kind of evident with what you're saying now? As I said, it's a hypothesis that you're coming up with, Paul. But was it kind of evident when Arthur came back at the end, and or not when Arthur came back and he met him in the dressing room and he's going, yeah, I'm really happy for you, what you've succeeded, I'm keeping an eye on you and blah. Like, was that kind of, like, obviously, no, he wouldn't have worked with him, but is that what you're trying kind of saying?
Yeah, but I think he was putting all that on for the two lads, to be honest with you.
Just for the camera.
Not just for the camera, I think just for the two lads. I thought that he didn't really care about them. If he really cared about Arthur, he would have done something about him being dropped from the school and looking for, was it $1,800? I thought that was disgraceful. But again, that was so sad. Like a rich school like that wouldn't release his grades until he paid a certain amount of money. Like, I thought it was scandalous.
Does that go back to the haves and the have-nots? If you're good at sport, you'll be accommodated and you'll be given stuff and you'll be given every support necessary. Whereas if you're seen, like, as I said, if you're not, you're just kind of thrown into the scrap heap and tough luck, sort out your own mess kind of thing.
Yeah, like, look at even the sponsors. He had, William had a sponsor who was paying for him and looked after him getting a summer's job. And what the first thing she did when her sponsor, like, they introduced William to her friends or his, the family's friends, like he was, you know, and then he got William's brother a job then as well. Like, it was all like why could that not be for Arthur in the school he was in? Would have, you know, it was, I don't know. I thought it was a brilliant, brilliant documentary, but I thought it was very, very sad in parts as well.
And I'd say you could probably look at it like, Laura, I know you said you get your students to watch it in college. But I'd say it's so deep if you looked at it from a different angle. Let's say, I know we're looking from coaching side, but I'd say if you look from a racial side or a societal, or like, I'd say there's so many layers in the film that
and it's the kind of film you could watch over and over again because you pick up different things. Mm. I know every time I watch it, I kind of pick up something that might be relevant to something that I've been working on, or a bit of research, or something I've read. And for me, that's why it, you know, probably controversial, but it, to me, it's what it has over other documentaries that are brilliant. You know, like maybe Senna or Last Dance or something, but that kind of sense of intimacy and the layers underneath it that kind of you keep unpicking maybe in different ways.
Yeah, excellent.
There was one layer, Colin, that you'd probably like, is that Isaiah Thomas was the hero at the start. He was a Chicago boy, and all the posters around, and everyone was wearing the Detroit tops, and that was at the when Detroit were successful. Yeah. And then a couple of years later, you just see more and more wearing the
Michael Jordan
Bulls gear. Bulls. Yeah, the Michael Jordan gear, and the Bulls are coming out. And like Isaiah Thomas was like hated then in Chicago after that, wasn't he? The rivalry he had with the Bulls.
Yeah, but Michael Jordan was all wrong there. Perfect. Any other things from the film, lads or Laura? Like, I think one of the things, I don't know if you noticed it. Have you seen The Wire, Laura? The TV show? No, you've seen The Wire. Did you notice the prop show lookalike as the head coach for who was it, King, I think? No, you have to go back and watch it.
The lead actor Avon Barkley went to St. Joseph's.
Avon Barksdale.
In real life.
Did he?
There's your Wire connection there.
Good man. And the prop Joe lookalike for the head coach for King.
Prop Joe.
Excellent. So no, look, I know we usually rate the coach and we talk about the coach, but I suppose this film wasn't really about the coach, because your man was as Damien Duff would say, he was a bit dinosaurs in his style of coaching and stuff like that. But like from a coaching perspective, from any average coach to watch it, like it's especially from the talent development side, I thought it was just really, really interesting, and in that a lot of things they kind of reaffirm, but you see a lot of things then that you kind of go, yeah, that's, you know what, that's actually important. No, and as you said, Laura, you kind of pick up something that's relevant to something you might be kind of thinking at the time. So I thought it was a really good look from that, because I'd say I seen it maybe probably 10 years ago, and it was just a good film. But to look at a different angle like that, I thought it was interesting.
And as you say, there's so many things that we couldn't even squeeze into this chat. You know, you could do a whole one about injury and injury management and that whole side of it, and how that affected William and his relationship with the coach and all of that. You could even, you know, you're talking about the role of strong women in there as well, which I feel I need to bring up too. But there's so much throughout it that just to sit and even have a think about it and think about even parallels to our own pathways and journeys that we see players on, I think it's a really interesting and valuable watch.
Yeah, and I know I mentioned women there, like Arthur's mother was a bit of a rock star with the troubles that she had at the start, and like when you probably look at it, his on court thing was sort of suffering around the same time as the troubles were having in the family, and when everything was a bit smoother in the family, you could see how his own game kind of improved as well, you know, like it wasn't just changing a school, there were so many factors to it, but yeah, the mother getting the college course done and stuff, yeah, she was a rock star.
I said there's so much you could talk about it just there. Laura mentioned the injury there and how the coach left it up to the player to say he was fit, and it's like it was disgraceful, like he could have absolutely ruined them. But we could go talk about that for another half an hour.
Another Booby Miles incident.
If our listeners are listening to this and they haven't watched the film, I go and watch it, and you'll get something completely different to what we're after discussing from it. Like, if you think about it, it's a 3-year biography of two people's lives, of not two families' lives, and two schools. There's so much in it, like, really, really is. And like, it is, it's probably hard to sit through it all, but if you did watch it in blocks, there's different things during the different years that really stand out as critical kind of coaching and learning moments.
It's just life. It's just like I lived in Chicago for a summer, and I was actually just Google mapped the distance of it. I think it was a 12-minute drive to where I was living in off the Golden Mile in Chicago for a summer to where they were. And it was like complete and utter different worlds, like worlds apart.
Yeah.
So it's said to watch it. If anyone hasn't seen it before, it's like a must watch, really. It's fantastic.
It's one of my favorite quotes from a sports documentary as well, was William at the end of it, where he says, people used to say, don't forget about us when I get to the NBA, but I should have said, don't forget about me if I don't make it. And for me, that was just so powerful.
It's a brilliant line, brilliant. Yeah.
Perfect. Laura, where can people find you? Because I know you put up a good bit of stuff on Twitter. What's your Twitter handle there, so any listeners can browse?
Look for Laura Finnegan on Twitter, and I've turned the PhD into a couple of short blog posts as well, which actually deals with some of the things that we've spoken about here in terms of siblings, parents, relative age, that kind of thing, and that's talent development in Irish football.
Excellent. Brilliant. Perfect. And we'll tag you, and any listeners can get following. As I said, I know I took one of the articles you shared just before Christmas about moving the coaching timeline, or not the coaching timeline, but there was a graph. And if we can get everybody to move a bit to the right, the standard of everybody raises. So I threw that to the boss and I said, that's what we need to do now with work. Instead of working with the top 30 fellas, let's work with 300. But we'll see how that goes down. Super stuff. Laura, thanks for your
time. Thanks, Laura.
Thanks, I enjoyed that.
Thanks, Laura. That was brilliant. Thank you. Appreciate it. Thanks, Colm, again.
Thanks for joining us today. Please leave a review on your favourite platform, and if you enjoyed it, tell a friend. You may also want to follow us on Instagram and Twitter at Roy Orbison Tattoo, and we appreciate any likes, retweets and comments. Next week, we will be watching We Are Marshall, and we will have the show available first thing Tuesday morning as always. Thanks, everybody.